Hi guys, and welcome to episode 17 of the Road CC podcast in association with Helix from Bont Cycling. Now, as always, my name is George Hill and I am your podcast host for today, and I pale in insignificance to who I'm speaking to though, because today we are speaking to none other than Chris Boardman, MBE, the new Commissioner for Active Travel England, which means that in addition to him having broken the hour record, in addition to him having worn the yellow jersey, in addition to him being the first cycling commissioner in Manchester, he is now basically in charge of cycling infrastructure at probably the most pivotal time when it comes to changing the way that people travel around the UK. So a bit of background about this. Chris and I have been talking for the last few months, and he's kind of been putting off coming on the podcast, and I couldn't really work out why. He's normally really, really keen to be involved in this kind of stuff, and it turns out that he was just being incredibly strategic because he knew this was coming down the line, and so he waited until we could discuss it. So we found out about this on Friday and it came out on Saturday. So we are one of the first people to speak to Chris about this new role. It's incredibly exciting. Chris is a fantastic orator. It's a really, really good interview. So we really hope that you guys enjoy it. So without further ado, here is Chris Boardman on the Road CC podcast.
I tried to hold off the podcast starting because I knew this was coming and I couldn't talk about it, but I thought, well, it'd be slightly richer if we could do it after the fact. So I'm glad we hung on.
Oh yeah. And it's peak week as well. You just starting and the highway code changes coming in as well. Absolutely. Yeah. It could not be timed better.
So plenty going on.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So much. So, I mean, maybe we could start off, maybe you can tell us a bit more about this new role and the kind of powers that you have to help with active travel.
The agency was announced well over a year ago as part of the gear change strategy that government produced, which is an absolutely sensational joined up plan for how to get public and active travel modes to work together. And it was, you know, a piece of genius. And I read it and I just thought, wow, just do that. There's no like, look at this, look for the flaws, this bit, it was just do that. If that is all we did, this country would change dramatically. So it's taken over a year. I've been helping on the fringes and then more and more involved in what Active Travel England needs to be. And it's a hugely complex thing to set up. It's a whole other business, if you like, that works with the Department of Transport and Government, but is not part of them. And that's the key bit. And that's the bit that's taken longest to get agreement over, because government doesn't like setting up arm's length bodies. It's another quango, if you like. So very, very carefully. And in this case, it was necessary. You need to move quickly. You need to make an awful lot of changes. And it needs the autonomy to do that. The strategy is agreed with government, but then the agency delivers it. So in a nutshell, it will hold the rules, if you like, all active travel infrastructure. So walking, cycling, wheeling, however you're getting about, not in a car, it will hold the rules. And those rules exist now, LTM 120, and will be developed further. And they essentially say you have to build good stuff and it has to be joined up or you don't get any money. And they say it then has the power to go, first of all, to inspect schemes or plans for schemes before they get funding, and then inspect them as they go along. And if they don't meet the standards, the cash can be clawed back. So it's got proper teeth. Also, it goes into any large planning. It will be a statutory consultee. So if somebody's building a big load of houses or an industrial estate, they must provide for active travel, and they are obliged to speak to Active Travel England planners to get agreement on those plans, which is just huge. And I think probably the most important third strand is Active Travel England will train and upskill local authorities to deliver this stuff because they've never had a budget. They've never had this as a constant part, not like highways where they have a constant stream of cash and jobs to do. They've never done this before. So the engineers don't exist. The expertise doesn't exist. It's small pockets. So we will disseminate that information and ultimately help. So it's nice, not you're not just judging, but you're actually helping them achieve the level required to get funding. So it's an enormous task. I'm relieved it's off. And hopefully in this year, we'll start to do business in full.
Amazing. Yeah, it sounds great. I mean, yeah, what I've seen in the last, well, especially in the last kind of 3 months where it gets towards the end of the year and then you see the councils coming in and, you know, they're like, oh, we need to use this budget. And you end up with, you know, they say, oh, we've got this cycle lane, but it's something that they've just kind of like squeezed in. So there's one near me, which is literally 30 meters long, where they obviously just built it because they needed to use up the budget, but it's completely useless. So yeah, it's really, really great that, you know,
it joins it up in the sense that you cannot get funding for something like that. And everybody in the chain is accountable for what they're doing. So, you know, we're all familiar with the types of infrastructure that you've described. They're not infrastructure, they're just ornaments, really, street ornaments that don't really do anything for anybody. And that won't be allowed to happen anymore. And that's a good use of public money. And it's, you know, you would hope that everybody would support that. We started it in Greater Manchester. I mean, essentially Greater Manchester was a 4-year degree course for me in active travel. And then I did an 8-month master's in wider transport towards the end. So it's just an invaluable experience to have worked with councils to see how they work, to see how they manage government in terms of funding.
Like, this is an absolute opportune moment, seeing the changes to the highway code, which are happening this weekend. So that's obviously that's going to be a huge change to kind of cycling safety and active travel in general. How long do you think it's going to be before we start seeing the impacts of these highway code changes?
So first of all, the highway code, all it's doing is reinforcing what good drivers do already. And I think the impact of it will be minimal, which might sound a bit pessimistic. It's not. It's a reinforcement of good practices, and it will take time. So there is no legal changes in the highway code, but now there is clarity. And we know that this document is used in courts. So when somebody says they walked out on the road in front of me, well, this guidance comes out, well, you passed a driving test, or you're expected to know the highway code. It's not optional. I don't know is not an excuse. You're expected to know this. And it says anybody turning must give way to anybody going straight ahead. Yeah. And that's going to be very helpful, but it's going to take time to filter through. The point is, it signals we have a hierarchy of road users. We have never had that before. And it's all just moving us in the right direction. So I would hope people don't expect huge things, but they have clarity. And if somebody says you should be in single file, say, actually, you don't read the highway code. The ambiguity is gone, and we can be thankful for that.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, the number of times where I've had, you know, where I've been on club runs and people have said, why are you cycling two abreast and kind of leaning out their window? It's like, well, that's what we're meant to be doing. Why, you know, you should know that. So, I mean, I guess, you know, exciting stuff. Really great week to speak to you. There's a lot to do. What is at the top of your inbox?
Well, number one is get the agency established so it can accept and administer the £2 billion budget. And that £2 billion is for this parliament as well. So the clock is ticking on that money. If it's not being spent, then there's always a chance that it will be reabsorbed into Treasury. So you have an annual allocation for that £2 billion. And if you're not spending it, then it's at risk. So with a whole new agency that doesn't exist and a workforce around the country that doesn't exist yet, it's going to be a pretty frantic 2 to 3 years. So just getting the agency up and running is number one, making sure that it knows how to work with government, how to work with the Department for Transport, who writes the regulations on things, you know, who holds the pen on this. There's so much behind the scenes, which is, you know, incredibly dry, fascinating to me because it's how you get good stuff to happen. There's a huge amount of interaction with other stakeholders, and that might be all those interested groups, so your British Cyclings and Living Streets and all of them, but also internally, we've got to speak to all the government departments that deal with housing, that deal with road safety laws, that deal with traffic regulation, all of those people, the police, active travel England now must have a really strong relationship and make sure that they put the needs of cyclists and people on foot first.
I think that it's Yeah, I mean, I come from the world of startups, so I kind of know all about how challenging it can be when you start from an idea. I mean, you're obviously slightly above the idea stage now, but kind of getting
The idea, but it's still a blank piece of paper, and a blank piece of paper is an exciting thing. The problem with it is it's blank. You know, you don't walk in and you've got a CEO and you've got operations managers and you've got project managers and engineers. You walk in and you've got nothing, and there's not even an inn. You know, we know it's in York. I've not been to York yet. I just know that that's where we've selected because we have an allocation of Department for Transport space there. So it's just blank, and we want to do it yesterday, and that's quite a challenge.
Nice. Well, a beautiful part of the country to do it.
But I have our hat somewhere. I mean, England is our remit, so most people will be out on the road. And obviously London, there'll be a lot of time spent interacting with other departments in London. But we've also got to do the training I mentioned. You know, we've got a lot of engineers to get up to speed, to upskill them, to write guidance. So that will be done collectively in York. And hopefully we'll be having cohorts from all over the country coming in and going, right, this is how you do junctions. This is how you get it done. This is how you consult with the public to give yourself the best chance, and all that's to come. And I think when you said starting with an idea, well, we've developed that idea in detail in Greater Manchester for 4 years. And we created a process for all of those things that works. And it's taken 4 years, but it's stood up to test, and it's functioning. So the intention is to do what it was even before Greater Manchester, which is we have an example at such a scale, it's unignorable. It was ignorable. Now let's make it even bigger. Let's scale it up.
Wow. Yeah, it's super exciting. Like when I heard the news, so we got the embargoed press release on Friday. And yeah, I was literally beaming all day. Because I was just so excited about the concept of, because we've obviously got people in government at the moment who are very, very kind of cycling orientated.
Some of them are,
some of them less so, but we have quite a cycling positive government at the moment. But having somebody who has the kind of, you know, the public facing passion that you do, I think is going to make that alone is going to make such a massive difference. One thing, you're obviously known as kind of, you know, the cycling innovator, you know, the secret squirrels, the Lotus bike, all that kind of stuff. How are you going to try and bring that level of innovation to this new role?
Well, the innovation comes in other places. So it's innovation is just problem solving. That's all it is. I mean, innovation is something when people put on their company strapline, we're going to be innovative. I was thinking, no, don't be innovative unless you absolutely have to, because innovative is risk. You know, you don't do something unless you absolutely have to. But sometimes the innovation is taking lots of things that are known and putting them together to create something new, or it's finding there's something blocking your way with something you want to do. So. You know, side road zebras, for example, we went, the rest of the world's doing this thing. We're not doing it. Why aren't we doing this thing? And we sort of found out in the bowels of DFT that, you know, we're not allowed. So rather than walk out and go, oh, it's not a shame, we went, okay, how do we get it done? Okay, let's create a study in Greater Manchester. Let's pay £250,000 for it and gather the evidence to go back. So we found a way around that problem. So that's where the innovation will come from here. It will be finding a way around a system that is built to stay the same at a time when you need to change and change quickly, which is two things that the big institutions don't like. So that's why this organization has to be arm's length. It has to be independent, because it's got to do things that its parent company, Department for Transport, perfectly understandably and reasonably, is not built for. So there's masses of innovation, but it's just not going to take the form of carbon fiber and CNC machine parts.
It's interesting that you said that, because so in 2013, well, with the Get Britain Cycling report in 2013 recommended appointing a national cycling champion, and you were kind of in the frame, you know, your name was kind of in the frame then, and you said that you'd only take it if you had, if you could do it in your own way. So I assume from that, from what you've just said, that you do have that level of independence that you were asking for.
Well, an independent body with 2 billion, a set of regulations that's already in place for the standards of infrastructure to enforce, and a strategy that says you must incorporate cycling and walking into all of your bus, your train, your road schemes going forward. That's about as good as it gets. It's like it's exponentially more than I ever thought that we'd get to. And we did it really quickly. So whatever one's opinion is on wider politics, this government has delivered for active travel something that we haven't seen in a lifetime. And it is a genuine opportunity that I would imagine is cross-party as well. You know, this transcends politics, I would hope. You know, this is health, this is climate, this is standard of living, this is leveling up. It is everything, because it's what links people together. So I am incredibly excited and very scared of the opportunity and the responsibility to get it right. So it is all consuming, as unfortunately my wife will tell you. She is pretty sick of hearing about dropped curbs and narrowing the radiuses at junctions at the moment. But it is utterly fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, on RoadCC, you know, we cover this kind of stuff a lot, and it does become, you know, even though we're kind of just reporting on it from the outside, it's so interesting, so interesting. And yeah, once you kind of get into it, it's one of those things where you can't not see it. It's a bit like what's that film with the sunglasses where you see, you know, as soon as he puts them on, he sees one thing, as soon as he takes them off, he sees another.
I know the film, but I know the experience. And you can't unsee. I mean, you mentioned wind tunnels, and the commonality is incredible, because it's all about people getting out their own way. It's not actually about rules and regulations. It's about human beings, fear of change, and it's exactly the same stuff: fear of risk, fear of losing, and how do you get people past that? Because if you ask anybody in the UK, would you like your kids to be able to walk or ride to school? You're not going to get many people to go no. So you go, okay, well, we all agree on the destination. So it's step one that, okay, but that's different. And what happens if you take that parking space away, and this is my mortgage, this business? So what happens if it's not good? And that's the kind of stuff that's in the way. So it's incredibly similar. And what we did in a wind tunnel, interestingly, which we then replicated with councils in Greater Manchester, and we're probably going to do nationally, is first thing we did is we gave the councils the pen and said, listen, if you don't want to do anything, let's not do it. Oh, but we do. Okay, where do you want to go? How would you do it? And we let them decide. In a wind tunnel, we learned really on the hard way. I won't go into the story, but don't tell athletes this is what you should do. Take them in the wind tunnel, show them the numbers, let them experiment. Then they'll ask questions about how can we get that number to go lower? And you go, well, why don't you try this? And they'll try it. And you give them a chance to experiment and own it. Ownership is key. And then we just did that with councils, and we'll do it again. So I'm a massive fan of trials for all of this stuff, because it gives people the courage to have a go at doing something different. But the trials have got to be large enough and meaningful and for a long enough amount of time to prove the case. Because that's the beauty of our product. If you try it, you know, if you let somebody do it and try it on, they'll prefer it. Waltham Forest is the best example. 47% of people objected to Waltham Forest being pedestrianised, and people protested with coffins on the shoulders saying this is the death of Waltham Forest. And they were lucky enough with Clyde Lokes to have a councillor who was strong enough to push through that. And then 3 years later, they did another poll. 1.7% of people would put it back. And that's, you know, that's key, I think. There's a huge amount of similarities, because all of it, be it in wind tunnels or government schemes, it all comes down to people and fear of change. And so it's actually a very simple task wrapped up in complex stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was going to say Waltham Forest is a really good example of, yeah, how like the positivity of how these changes can be made. And it's interesting that you're talking about the kind of the trials and that kind of thing, because that's when you think about how basically any successful modern company works. It works in that way, in terms of you create the trial, you do the measurements, and then you can move forward, because you can't. The age of gut feeling should be gone, because it doesn't help anybody, because all you're doing is
horrendous. I mean, it's an instinct of, you know, you hear a loud noise, you jump up a tree as quickly as you can. You know, it is thousands of years old, and it kept you safe. So gut feeling instinct is perfectly understandable, because it is instinctive. But sometimes it sends us totally the wrong direction. I mean, helmets and high vis is the perfect example in our world, when people just can't. It just, facts get trampled under emotions, as in, well, this is terrible, you should be. Nobody's even listening to the facts. Nobody says, oh, this guy's been doing this for 20 years. Well, why isn't he promoting this thing? His mother got crushed by a car while wearing high vis and helmets. Why isn't he promoting? And to start with that question would be the way to go. But there's a lot of emotive stuff that we've got to deal with. And that's everything that we're doing, you know, low traffic neighborhoods, anything. You have to start with dealing with people's emotions. And if you don't, you're going to have a battle.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's one of those. Yeah, it's like what Steve Peters says in his book. That's the you know, the chimp paradox. Yeah.
Today's episode of the Road CC podcast is brought to you in association with Helix Cycling Shoe from Bont. A new standard in performance footwear, the Bont Helix combines a race-proven anatomic fit enhanced like never before with a newly reimagined closure system. Single boa fastenings make for the easiest adjustment ever, and unique internally rooted Kevlar laces encircle the feet, eliminating pressure points. The Helix shoe is light and stiff to maximise both pedal power and arch support. All this, together with the ergonomic heat-moldable soles that have long set Bont cycling apart, Helix offers you performance and comfort without compromise.
You just said, you know, obviously this thing is all encompassing. It's taking up, I can imagine, pretty much all of your time. But, you know, this is Road CC. I would be, I would probably be slaughtered if I weren't to ask you some nerdy cycling questions about technology and stuff. So, Boardman, what kind of work are you still doing there?
Well, I mean, the bike company does really well now, and you'll see that there's a big move towards gravel, which it's the only bike I keep at home. You know, I love the, I don't care about going fast now, and I love the flexibility of my rides 2 hours on the Wirral. I stitch together bits of quiet road, and then I'll go on to a bit of track. I really like the mix, and the rest of the world sort of starting to feel very much the same way. So I think giving people an adventure is the focus, and that's the way that the product's gone. There's the utility side, obviously, which we've always done. There's always been a fascination with road bikes, and they can be beautiful things. Carbon fibre is a lovely material to sculpt things out of. And the aim has been, since 2007, when I established the company, to give people a product at an accessible price. So drawing the line, the balance is drawing the line between making sure it's accessible, but not doing something that's cheap and not doing something that's tat. So we come down a long way. So that those principles are in place, really. I think you're seeing in the products a reflection of my own preferences at the moment.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's some really good stuff that's coming at the moment. And I mean, yeah, one of the things that Jack, our editor, really wanted to know is, what bikes do you currently have?
Well, as I say, a gravel bike. I keep a hardtail mountain bike, and that goes with me on the sleeper train to Scotland, because I try to spend quite a lot of time up there. Sorry, just close that down. But around where I live on the Wirral Peninsula, the gravel bike is by far the predominant beast that I utilize for the reasons I've just covered. And I don't actually keep a road bike at home. I don't need it, so I'll just borrow one from the guys when I go and do a sportif. But the irony at the moment is I'm not getting a lot of time to ride a bike because I'm trying to enable lots of people to ride a bike.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I actually have to give up some cycling time in order to write about cycling.
So, yeah. Well, I've got an aero road bike behind me.
Nice. Yeah, I can see.
On a Swift setup. And I always said, you know, indoor trainers, it feels like failure. You know, we've got all this world outside, and even if it's muddy and wet, it's like real. And riding in a box, staring at a screen, just feels like failure. And then I tried it a year ago and I thought, bloody hell, this is really convenient, isn't it? I can actually keep reasonably healthy. I can have a meeting, go and do, you know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, grab a shower, I'll be back, you know, all really quickly, and it's efficient. So I've reluctantly succumbed and utilize it a lot.
Nice. Yeah, there has definitely been, and I think that the lockdown has really pushed loads and loads more people into indoor cycling. We've obviously seen loads of, I personally don't understand it, but indoor cycling kit.
I'll go so far. I mean, I have lots of routines in my own head that you know, they go back a decade, well, god, quarter of a century. So, you know, just how to get the most out of half an hour. And I'll just do those while I'm looking at Watopia or whatever it might be at the same time.
Oh, lovely. Going slightly into the, you know, professional game, what are your thoughts on the current breed of hour record breakers? So, you know, your kind of Filippo Gannas and that kind of thing.
Well, records are made to be broken, as the, you know, the old cliche, and that's the point of them, isn't it? And I think what people enjoy about it is there's no second place. The beauty of the hour record is the risk involved, where somebody says, I'm going to do this. And they've generally done a fair bit of homework, but they might lose. And you can empathize with that. And when you're watching it, you are on tenterhooks waiting to see what's going to happen. And we know with the hour record, you know, it might look great for over half of it, and then you'll start to decay and all of that stuff. And there are moments when new technology tends to come to the fore, at least it was. I mean, the UCI has really got on top of its rules now and tends to be stopping a lot of that. But it's been amazing to watch the evolution of technology. The hour record, again, is where it comes out, that we made big leaps forward from 2008 to 2016. And now it's leveling off, and the rest of the world has not just caught up, they sort of picked up the baton, really, to mix metaphors, and found new ways of doing things and slightly better positions. I really like seeing it. I really enjoyed watching Dan Bigham and the guys just decide to do team pursuiting differently about 5 years ago, three years ago. It was great when you've done something your whole life in a given way, and then somebody comes and looks at it differently and finds a new thing. And a lot of that is visible in record attempts.
Yeah. So
I answered your question then. I kind of just went all the way around it, but...
No, that's great. Yeah. We spoke to Dan in a podcast last season. And he's got some really, really, really interesting ideas. And yeah, the way that he's approached it as well, just like super, super interesting.
Dan had he's not the best athlete in the world, he'd probably say that himself. But it's what he's got to work with. This is the only engine, and they did the same with the team pursuits. This is the only engines we've got. How do we squeeze the most out of them? And they just thought about it ever so slightly different, and that different viewpoint, they just saw different answers. We actually thought about it going back to the late 80s, and there was myself, Colin Sturgis, Graham O'Brie, and Sean Wallace. So we had two kilo riders, an endurance rider, and Graham, whatever Graham was, something in the middle of the mix there. And we went, okay, well, why don't we get Sean Wallace to just do 1 kilometer absolute flat out and bail out? And then we'll get Colin to do it. And so we thought about not doing equal turns, and we bottled it. We didn't have the courage. We didn't have the courage to try doing something differently and to step outside of the the standard methodology. So it's great when deceased people bring in new ideas.
Yeah, definitely. It's I mean, of all the people to talk about bringing new ideas, you're probably, you know, in cycling especially, you're probably the chief proponent.
Well, I'd offer you a rebuttal, actually. I don't think I was. I think I spotted new ideas and leveraged them. So Graham O'Bree was the innovator, and he never fully got credit for it. But, you know, he was the person who had the courage to say, okay, well, I'm going to tuck my arms up, because if aero's the thing, I'm going to get rid of these two big cylinders. And everybody took the piss, including me, I'm ashamed to say. Because he was being different. And in my case at the time, when I was a young lad, it was threatening. So he had the courage to do something different. And when the UCI looked at it and said, well, you can't do that, because they didn't like different, he saw another gap and said, okay, I'll stretch my arms out in front of me. So he was the innovator, that kind of thinking, and I just capitalized on it. Lotus Spikes, that was Mike Burrows. So if you like, I was somebody scanning the horizon for things and picking them up. If I brought anything, it was spotting the good ideas and I don't know what you want to call it, really, capitalizing on them. So I think it's an important distinction, because there's a lot of people out there. The Lotus bike just swamped Mike Burrows, but Mike Burrows made that bike in the 80s and Lotus polished it. And they just get mentioned in the footnotes when actually it's, they were the true innovators.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think is going to be the next big technological advancement in bikes? When we first met, we were talking about disc brakes, believe it or not. And we were talking about whether that would kick on. But what do you think is the next big thing?
Well, I could see disc brake coming. I mean, we did it. Hydraulic disc brakes are very, in 2007, they went on all the hybrids and all the mountain bikes. And as soon as they made it onto a road bike, you could see that's where it's going. And I don't know if you remember the hysteria around, this is going to be dangerous. And, you know, there's a lot of parallels to what we're seeing in highway code and traffic. You know, people just scared of change. They don't like it. And then you give it a year and everyone goes, oh, actually, it's fine, isn't it? And nobody comes up and says, yeah, I really got that wrong. They just go quiet and it carries on. So I think in terms of innovation, I don't know is the shortest and bluntest answer. And isn't that quite exciting? But I think the potential for wireless is huge, isn't it? We've scratched the surface with wireless. The potential for utilization of batteries is massive. That will keep developing again. And then the market is there. So it will reward the R&D in that area. So I think very much e-bikes is just going to get more and more refined. I think material science, that'll move forward slowly, but less speed, because it's because there's huge investment behind that to actually make it work. But if you look, the best place to look if you want to know what's coming next is look outside of cycling. Look to Formula One, look to aerospace, look at what's out there. Because when we picked up the R&D program in 2004, people came in from other industries and went, well, why don't you just put the seams in the right place on the arms of your suits? You know, what do you mean? Yeah, well, if you can't change a shape, this is what you do to manage airflow. And that's pretty standard in our business. And they were almost embarrassed telling us. So the knowledge is out there, just that we're very cottage industry and don't even look. We just think cycling, and we look inside cycling for innovation when it's elsewhere. You know, look at what's happening with phones, look at what's happening in aerospace. All of those places is what will filter to us. And what they've got now, we'll get in 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's interesting what you said about the batteries. I mean, we saw the new Cannondale Synapse that came out last week with the battery, the integrated battery for use initially. Well, initially they're using it for the radar system and kind of integrated lights, but the potential for that in terms of where you could take it around the bike, essentially, you know, being able to integrate a non-e-bike battery on a bike is massive. You can potentially do so much with it.
Well, I've always thought, and I've got tens of design sketches from quite a while ago with batteries, in that you've got this, you've got a frame that's hollow. What a waste, you know, in terms of carrying fluids, in terms of carrying batteries, and it's, you've just got this space that's there. I think one place to look for which innovations will progress the fastest is what's easiest for the manufacturer as well, because they're going to want to do things. So wireless is not just quite cool for us, and it's really slick, and it makes your bike look cleaner. It's easier for the manufacturer. It's easier for the bike shop. You don't have to thread wires through a frame and try and pull them out somewhere else. And so that will get a lot of emphasis, because it makes everybody's life easier, and it makes a nicer product.
Oh yeah, 100%. Chris, I think that was all of the questions that I had. I'm really, really excited about the commissioner role. I think that it's going to be a game changer, basically.
It will be, if we get it right, and that's my that will be my consuming passion for the next probably 3 years. But I think we're entering the era of the bicycle, you know, climate change. Once we get around to actually addressing the biggest crisis of all, and that we're all, I don't know if you've seen the film Don't Look Up, but you know, it's that instinct that we were talking about clashing with intellect. And I think this, once we get around to it or start to get scared of the right things, the bicycle is the answer. It always has been. And it makes a nicer place to live. So hopefully this is the bicycle renaissance, and it will go down in history as such.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we should make that. You should make that a sticker. The bicycle is the answer.
A quiet revolution. That was a phrase I was trying to get going a few weeks ago.
I like it. Yeah, it's good.
A quiet revolution.
Yeah. Oh, Chris, thank you so much. It's been fantastic.
I'll get back to it, and maybe we'll pick up again in a few months, and you can see where we're up to.
And there we have it. I think that you will agree with me that Chris is a fantastic person to interview. He has some amazing ideas, and I'm really, really excited for the stuff that he's going to be doing in this new role. I think that he's just the right man for the job. We've got a few other people lined up for the podcast, and I'm really, really excited to talk to you guys about them as well. I will be revealing them closer to the time when we've got everything nailed down, but this was a really, really strong start. So I really hope that you guys found that as fascinating as I did. I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts. You can find us on social media, just search for Road CC, or you can send us an email to podcast@road.cc. So as always, cycle safe. Bye.